So which department are you with?
Let's just say I belong to another branch of Starfleet Intelligence. Our official designation is Section 31.
Never heard of it.
We keep a low profile. Works out better that way for all concerned.
And what does Section 31 do? Apart from kidnapping Starfleet officers?
We search out and identify potential dangers to the Federation.
And once identified?
We deal with them.
How?
Quietly.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, making sure he's got all those endorphins shooting into his brain.
Okay, well this week we are going to talk about Section 31, The Spy Who Phased Me.
What does that even mean, Cam?
It doesn't really mean anything, but we had two titles that seemed to work pretty well, so we mashed them together. But we're actually going to talk about all of the spy agencies on Star Trek, from the Tal Shiar to the Obsidian Order, and of course Section 31, because, you know, there was a scene dropped from Discovery, a cut scene that could hint that we're going to see some spy craft on Star Trek in the painfully near future.
Painfully near? Wow, okay. Well, why don't
well, it depends whether you're looking forward to more Section 31 or not, and we'll get to that later.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go into the painful past, as you would call it, and talk about, I guess, the first, like, most notable spy that we saw in Star Trek, which, of course, when I think spy, I think Arne Darvin from The Trouble with Tribbles.
I think all Star Trek fans do.
Yeah. Man, that was a yarn for the ages when you think about spycraft. A darn for the ages. No, but it is interesting because, I was thinking about this initially with the revelation that Arne Darvin was, in fact, a Klingon this whole time. He, of course, was that administrator on the space station K-7 in charge of all that grain.
Right.
And I was like, that guy is not really a spy. That's so lame. But then I realized, if you're a spy, you don't want to have, like, a big neon billboard over your head that screams, I'm shifty. I should not be trustworthy. I'm just a spy. I mean, this guy was a bit of a feckless dork, but that's what he was there to do.
He was kind of effective, though. He snuck by for a long time undercover.
I think he snuck by for another 100 years afterwards, because you did see him again in Trials and Tribulations, and I guess never got to change back and becoming like a regular looking Klingon.
Arne Darvin was more effective at his job than Ash Tyler.
Ash Tyler lasted about 6 months.
Yeah.
Arne Darvin lasted about 80 to 100 years.
It's really interesting to me that this character of Arne Darvin is introduced in this comedic episode, and it's a really fun episode, of course. But I mean, the idea of Klingons genetically making themselves up to look like another alien is interesting because, you know, the Klingons in the original series are so, like, they're shifty. You know, they're known to be very untrustworthy and kind of more like the Romulans we would see later in other series. Like, that sense of always being up to no good. Like, Klingons later were more defined as, like, honor-bound, sort of like samurai types, warrior types. But in the original series, like, it makes complete sense that you would have a Klingon do this. And it's interesting that they never pick up on that thread again until Discovery.
Okay, well, let me pitch this to you, though. When Bones does his tricorder readings and says, hey, this guy's a Klingon,
yeah,
he didn't really have to try very hard. How many, like, say, physicals did Ash Tyler go through where, like, he fooled everyone? Did Arne Darvin get, like, the real cheap version of this procedure, like, 10 years later? Or what happened?
Was it the cheap version? Because he seemed to pass a little better than Ash Tyler to a certain degree, too.
He didn't really have those memory engram problems that
Maybe
Ash
that was
Tyler...
the issue, yeah. Arne Darvin, he just had more of the cosmetic look done that, like, you know, Kira or Troy did in some of the episodes we'll talk about later. Maybe that was the deal. He didn't have this whole mashing up of, I don't know, I never quite understood the science of what they did to Ash Tyler.
Yeah.
You know, what part of the bodies came from which, but...
He just stayed as far away as the House of T'Kuvma that he could.
Yeah.
You know, he did not want to get mixed up with anybody associated with that.
Yeah. But we did see that on the original series as well with the Andorians. Of course, there was the Orion in Andorian, you know, makeup, of course, and Journey to Babel. So that was an original series staple. It's just interesting that, like, that's a really interesting germ of an idea for further exploration when you get to, you know, a series with a lot more time, like, say, Next Gen, where you have 7 seasons, or when you're getting into things like DS9, which have 7 seasons with serialized storytelling. It's interesting that they kind of just dropped that whole idea and moved on.
It seems like the 1960s would have been like a prime era to, you know, tell these kind of analogies about spies and all that.
Well, it's very Cold War, obviously. Yeah.
So that's kind of a bummer. But what do you think was a better spy story, like Journey to Babel or else The Trouble with Tribbles?
I think I would say the Journey to Babel is a better one, just because, I mean, Trouble with Tribbles is just so heightened and comedic, whereas I think with the Journey to Babel, the stakes feel a little more extreme, and just the sense of this character passing as an Andorian, it feels like more of it was a intense mission to undergo. Whereas when you're looking at Arn Darvin, so much that's going on around him is so wacky and goofy that I think it's easy to not give him the credit. Maybe he deserves for what he pulled off.
So, you know, let's say Journey to Babel is more in the vein of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Trouble with Tribbles is more in the vein of, say, Get Smart.
That's, pretty accurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Why don't we jump over to, I think, the next big one here. Look, there might be a spy here or there in maybe an episode or two that we miss, but I think we want to hit, like, the big ones. And I think the next big one is the introduction of the Tal Shiar. And this comes in Face of the Enemy from Star Trek The Next Generation, which I think this might be one of Troy's best episodes. Definitely in the top three for
There's
me.
There's so much competition. So much. Violations, Man of the People.
Anyways. But moving forward, look, this is kind of our introduction. This is literally the introduction to the Tal Shiar. And we have, again, this cosmetic surgery, which seems to be a big thing that all spy agencies really love to do.
Well, it makes sense. There are, like, real-world applications to this where people would pose, say, as a Russian or something like that. So, I mean, it's just a more extreme sci-fi version of that.
It's a sci-fi version, yeah. But it is, like, a thread that I think we'll see carried on in other series. But how do you think this works as maybe a big spy episode versus, say, the last two that we're talking about? Because I think it's quite effective at just ratcheting up the tension and establishing the stakes, as you mentioned, in Journey to Babel, and giving Troy something to do without making her look foolish as, you know, somebody who's in over her head the entire time.
And also explaining how to use her empath powers in a way that actually is cool. Because, I mean, a lot of the time, Troy's just on the bridge being like, I sense no ulterior motives, Captain. It's like, great. Whereas in this case...
It's kind of difficult to do over a view screen.
Yeah.
You know, where somebody's a couple light years away from you.
Yeah, or she'll be just like, I sense nothing. And then something happens.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Oh, that's awkward. But I mean, in this case, this was a fantastic showcase to really show what Troy could do with those powers and how she could be invaluable, in this case, as a spy. And I think this episode is actually really important, and that it really grounds what Star Trek spy stories will be, and that they're definitely more like Jean Le Carré versus like James Bond. Like, there is a lot more depth to them and a lot more intrigue and a lot of, like, not flashy spy stuff. Like, you're not seeing Troy take down, you know, the whole enemy ship, you know, like James Bond at the end. It's like leading to a defection, right? Like a defection through deceit, which is very like old-timey kind of spy craft. It's not like the big explosive stuff you'd see, especially in the 60s onwards.
Which I really do appreciate. And I think
it's very Star Trek. I mean, to tie like Le Carre storytelling to Star Trek actually makes a lot of sense.
Well, she had to figure her way out of the situation with her own smarts and ingenuity versus just, you know, punching people really hard and getting into a shuttle and escaping to the Enterprise, which I appreciate a lot here. Going forward, I mean, do you appreciate how this is, I guess, sowing the seeds for all the distrust that even Romulans have for the Tal Shiar? Like, everybody within the Romulan fleet, all they can do is talk about how much they hate the Tal Shiar here.
I know. Actually, I think that's one of the genius moves of this episode, is to position the Romulan Star Empire versus the Tal Shiar and have this mistrust. I think that's actually genius.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we always look at the Romulans on, especially with Next Generation onwards, as sort of this veiled threat. Like, they're always kind of that weapon, that finger's always on the trigger, but you never know what they're really up to because they're always kind of sneaky. And the fact that they have their own spy agency that they don't trust is actually really fun, I think. And I love that there's the sequence where Troy, you know, is posing as this character and the captain of the ship or the commander is like taking jabs at her to test her Romulan knowledge, basically.
It's I always like those awkward dinner scenes in you know, film and TV. This is one for the ages, too.
Maybe that's an episode we should do one day, awkward Star Trek dinners. Well, there's a lot. Just off the top of my head.
I can think of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. That has a great one as well.
Haven.
Think about all the awkward dinners that Chakotay and Tom Paris had with Anorax.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in Year of Hell. Okay, Cam, I think we figured out what we're doing in a few weeks at least. So, Okay, so this is not going to be the last time we bring up the Tal Shiar, but mm-hmm. why don't we take a bit of a mosey on over to the Obsidian Order, which, according to my Deep Space Nine companion, was originally supposed to be known as the Gray Order.
Oh, and, that's a little on the nose.
It is, and the writer, Robert Hewitt Wolf, he said that then he found out there's something called the Gray Council on Babylon 5. So he changed it. He made a list of all these rocks and gems, and he landed on Obsidian, which, okay, I kind of dig. And he said that he actually likes the sound of the Obsidian Order way more than the Gray Order.
I actually think it might have the coolest name of any of the Star Trek spy agencies.
I don't know, Tal Shiar, Cam.
I mean, Tal Shiar's okay.
What does it even mean?
Well, it was named after a Vulcan martial arts technique called Tal Shaya. And I guess, you know, the writer was like, yeah. Tal Shiar, that's pretty cool. Okay. But then I'm like, would the Romulans be insulted to be named after a Vulcan martial arts move?
Well, no, I think it's like from like common etymology, right?
Okay.
So like that's how I can justify that connection between the Romulans and the Vulcans. So
is that on the nose though, that it's a martial arts technique?
I could buy it.
Okay.
Well, with regards to the Obsidian Order, though, we get our first introduction to them in The Wire, mm-hmm. which, if we're going to be talking spies in Star Trek, I mean, this is one of Garak's best episodes. Like, just such a showcase for him, where, of course, and I alluded to it at the beginning, where we find out there's this biotechnology implanted in his brain that was there to give him endorphins, essentially, whenever he was undergoing intense interrogation. Mm-hmm. What happens when this miserable, exiled person constantly uses this thing to just kind of feel free while he's living in exile?
Yeah.
And the thing starts to malfunction. And so we really see how this Obsidian Order operates. And it's kind of a fascinating showcase, both for the character, as well as what this agency is willing to put their own operatives through as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you always get the sense with the Cardassians that they're going to have more extreme approaches to things. So it makes complete sense to me that they would do this to one of their operatives. And I like the idea that the Obsidian Order members, like, they kind of operate independently and have very limited knowledge. So they're all these separate cells all over the place. Yeah. And that they put these trigger mechanisms in them to essentially keep them in place and prevent them from, you know, being able to break during torture and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, I get the sense, we'll talk about Section 31 later, but I feel like Section 31 has, I mean, they aren't the most wonderful employers in the world, but I feel like they have a modicum of interest in their, you know, agents, whereas I feel like with the Obsidian Order, they'll cut you in a second and not care.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
But this is also the introduction of one Enabran Tain as well, which mm-hmm. I guess if we're talking about notable, you know, Obsidian Order members, there's pretty much just two in the series. So I really like the fact that, I think what we kind of get from Enabran Tain is like, we find out more about their relationship further on in the series, but
he's a great dad. Yeah, one of the best.
Yeah. I don't want to know what that means about your relationship with your father, Cam. But he is kind of like a ruthless dude, you know, despite his, what we find out is a much deeper relationship than we would have suspected.
Right.
He's willing to let this go on here. Mm-hmm. So why don't we go into another one? Because I was talking about how they love cosmetic surgery here.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite Kira Nerys episodes is Second Skin, where we find out the Obsidian Order gave her surgery to look like a Cardassian, similar to maybe what we saw in Face of the Enemy. There's always a lot
I've never made that connection that those episodes are similar.
Well, you know, maybe a few people out there have, Cam.
I remember when I first saw this episode, I had no awareness of it.
Yeah.
Actually, sorry, I saw Face of the Enemy second.
Oh,
so
did
I
you?
Actually saw Second Skin first. But I remember when I watched Face of the Enemy, I was like, wait a minute.
This is a Kira episode.
Yeah, this looks a little familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's literally a spy agency kidnaps Kira.
Yeah.
And she wakes up looking like a Cardassian. Sound familiar? Yeah, we just talked about it about 7 minutes ago here on the podcast. Yeah. But this is great again because I like what the Obsidian Order is doing in that, like, they're looking at potential dissidents. And to them, I mean, it's dangerous if these dissidents are not being exposed. So they want to expose this woman who had at least a passing resemblance to Kira back in the day.
Yeah.
How is it, though, that perhaps their voices were identical, Cam?
That's just a happy accident.
Okay. Yeah. I get it. I would have hoped that maybe he just did not remember. Sorry, and of course, remember, this is she's impersonating somebody's daughter.
Yeah, that would be a Legate Gamorre.
And she keeps insisting, no, that's not who I am. Like, mm-hmm. And because, of course, much like one Ash Tyler, they insist that she had the memory Ingram stuff right. go bad as well. So I think this is a kind of a fun one. I think it was the moment I really realized what a great character was when I was watching this first run with regards to Garrick.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember there's a moment where they vaporize somebody and Garrick's response is pity. Yes. I rather liked him.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I actually really like the character of Legate Gamor too, introducing him, because it adds a little bit of complexity to the Cardassian race, because a lot of the Cardassians we see on the show are pretty sinister, whether it's, you know, your Gul Dukats or Gul Madreds or a lot of the ones that popped up on TNG. And so when you introduce a character like Gamor, who is very, you know, affectionate towards Kira, who he thinks is his daughter, and, you know, is affectionate towards Kira going onwards, I like the sense that it puts a positive face on the Cardassians, because it's very easy to paint an entire alien race as evil or whatever, or sinister.
And you get into that risk of them just being kind of one note.
Sure.
And, you know, which I think that's the fascinating thing about the Cardassians is, as much as they had very distinct character traits about their alien species, mm-hmm. I never felt as if they were a one-note species, though.
No.
Like, they could always surprise me. And, yeah, the Obsidian Order was great at doing that, too.
Yeah, but, you know, when you watch an episode like, say, Tribunal, where you see their justice proceedings, you're like, oh, these are an evil alien species. But I like the Gamor goes against that and, you know, is sympathetic towards the dissidents. And, again, it's like introducing more complexity into the universe of Star Trek through these spy stories that I think is invaluable.
So what we did find out throughout the course of Deep Space Nine, and specifically in the episode Defiant, the Obsidian Order not actually allowed to be like a paramilitary organization, not allowed to possess, say, you know, ships, etc., etc. We find out that they were not following that mandate, and they were teaming up with the Tal Shiar the entire time, building a fleet to take on the Dominion. This, of course, was in the Dias Cast and Improbable Cause two-parter, which ends up with that battle over the Omarian Nebula, which was the original, I guess, homeworld of the Founders that we were introduced to in the Search Parts 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Obsidian Order gone now.
Right.
And presumably, at that time anyways, Anna Brentain, who was leading this fleet.
Yeah.
So, I guess what I wonder here, Cam, is just how good is this intelligence agency if they could not suss out that they were falling into a trap and eventually were obliterated?
And taken out by a changeling infiltrator in their midst.
Yeah, that was a Romulan as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you bring that up because I had forgotten about it. And it was ultimately that Romulan changeling traitor that was helping Odo out as well in that situation, because no changeling has ever hurt another, Cam.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I do question how great a spy agency is if it can be taken out single-handedly. Like, I feel like there should always be offshoots elsewhere to step in if, you know, the main group gets wiped out.
Well, and you brought up that a very good point a few moments ago, in that the Obsidian Order has all these distinct cells within them. Mm-hmm. And it's actually smart to a certain degree if, you know, sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. You know,
sure.
It insulates these organizations. But the fact that, like, this can all be just destroyed in one fell swoop, I think maybe what happened is they just did not follow their own advice. Look, the Obsidian Order would still exist if they decided not to go all paramilitary, like they were mandated to do. So that said, the Tal Shiar, it was not obliterated, despite this destruction of its fleet here, because we did get them popping up and, say, mentions, at least, in the Pale Moonlight. And it also became a very topical sort of organization with regards to Section 31 episode we'll talk about in a few moments, Inter Arma Enim Silent Legis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I memorized that. And
can you say that and C.V. Packham back and forth about five times?
I won't do it five times. I'll do it once.
Okay.
Inter Arnum Enum Silent Legis, C.V. Packham Parabellum.
Awesome.
There you go. That's making it on the best
I'll just loop
of
it five times.
Yeah, thank you. But we do have the Tal Shiar persisting even after this. So, Cam, if we had to compare the Obsidian Order to the Tal Shiar, A, tell me what your favorite organization is, and then B, tell me what do you think is just objectively a more effective organization, your own personal feelings aside.
I mean, okay, if you ask me which one is my favorite, I'm going to say the Obsidian Order. And that's really because it's personified by characters like Garrick and Tane, who I think are hugely fascinating and complex characters who bring a lot of depth to the show. Whereas I feel like the Tal Shiar, I just don't get that level of character writing.
Yeah.
You know, we see, like, obviously Troy is, you know, involved with them, but Troy's not a member of the Tal Shiar.
No.
And a lot of the Tal Shiar stuff is kind of spoken off, kind of secondary. Even, you know, we talk about this DS9 when Tal Shiar's involved in this, the battle in the Nebula. it's really about the Obsidian Order. So, I mean, to me, I mean, if you ask me which one is more effective, I think I would probably say the Tal Shiar. Because the Tal Shiar is always kind of hiding in the shadows. They're never wiped out. The Obsidian Order is going all in on this big gambit. And
that's my favorite TNG two-parter.
I could have used some spycraft, I think, that one. But, I mean, you know, you see
Or some intelligence.
Well, here's the question is, you know, are the Tal Shiar just a better-run organization than the Obsidian Order?
I would say that maybe they are less prone to hubris, because I think that was a big issue. But it's also surprising that Enrin Tain could be misled to such a degree. But I wonder if it's kind of a guy who's over the hill, he's going on his one last big stand, and he's able to gather enough goodwill amongst all these other big players that he can convince everyone to do this. I wonder if the downfall of the Obsidian Order could be pinned directly on Enrin Tain to a certain degree.
Well, he was no spring chicken.
No.
And I would think you would want someone a little more, you know, not young, but younger, and maybe with some newer ideas. Like, I think that may have been the problem.
Yeah.
Tain was not a young guy. Like, if you throw someone like Garrick in there leading it, maybe he's got some new ideas and actually can take it into the next era. Whereas, like, I feel like Tain was thinking backwards a lot of the time.
Yeah, I agree.
And just was stifled, I think, by, you know, he had his issues with Garrick and all that sort of stuff. Like, he was not, I don't think, in the clearest shape of mind in the episodes we saw him in.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, he seemed a little...
like, you mean when he was dying?
Yeah, especially when he was dying.
Yeah. But at Camp before... Okay, so we will get to Section 31, but before there, I think there's a very important episode that kind of lays the groundwork to a certain entry point for Section 31. And honestly, I just want any excuse to talk about our man Bashir. If we're talking about the evolution of spycraft in Star Trek, we have Julian Bashir, initials JB, doing a James Bond-esque sort of holosuite program, which one of the like best holodeck episodes of all time in Star Trek period here. But I think there's some very good insights that we can gather both into Garrick here, where he is providing some tutelage to Bashir, as well as just why Section 31 would be interested in Bashir beyond just his, you know, genetically enhanced features that they find out about later here. But for you, does this work as a spy episode in kind of the way that we are talking about it, or is it I guess more of just kind of a one-off fun sort of holodeck malfunctions episode to you?
I mean, I think it works as both. I think you could just look at it as a fun holodeck episode and think it's a blast, and it actually justifies the holodeck malfunction in a way that I think, you know, in a much better way than TNG often did, or Voyager for that matter. But I you know, I think so it is just a total lark episode, and as a James Bond spoof it's a blast. But I do think there's a reason they mention, you know, Bashir's James Bond adventures when he's recruited in the episode Inquisition. You know, they're referring to his love of, like, spy stories and things like that. Like, you can see Ian Ourman Bashir. Bashir is in this very dangerous spy situation and is using quick thinking and improvisation to make his way through this series of encounters, not just surviving himself, but having to save the lives of the entire crew. So, I mean, is it colorful and goofy? Yeah, but it's also a really good test of what he can bring to a potential situation.
There's a couple interesting points that Garrick also brings up throughout this journey here. And he tells Julian, look, a real intelligence agent has no ego, no conscience, no remorse.
Classic James Bond. No ego whatsoever.
No, exactly. But do you think that fundamental dichotomy between, say, Garrick and Bashir is why Garrick actually is a good choice to be an intelligence operative, and maybe why Bashir, Section 31 was trying to recruit him hard.
Yeah.
Bashir kept pushing away, and I wonder if that is kind of a reason why, you know, Garrick is a better choice to be an intelligence operative than Bashir.
Well, I mean, Bashir has too much, like, cockiness and too much, I mean, he's just too compassionate a person.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to be a spy, you kind of have to be pretty indifferent to a lot of what's going on, or at least just be able to bury it. And I don't think Bashir can. He's too just a character. He's always trying to fight for at least the side of what he thinks is right. Whereas, like, you know, an effective agent like Garrick is like, well, which way do I got to go? Okay, I can pull that off.
Well, he also says something else very interesting to Bashir, which is the reason you're playing all these games, Julian, is because you think you're a hero, but you know deep down that you're not.
Mm.
And I think this begs the question,
Is Bashir an insecure character?
Well, sure. Yeah. I think we know the answer to that. But are intelligence operatives or spies, are they actually heroes?
Well, I mean, when we look at a character, you know, like a lot of these spy figures, they are the hero of their own story. They believe what they're doing is going to, you know, change the galaxy for the better. So they have to very much believe, I guess, that they are ultimately the good guys.
But would you...
Or at least delude themselves into thinking that.
But from our audience perspective, would you call any of these people heroes, I guess, in the classic sense?
Tane is definitely a hero in my book.
Okay.
One of the greatest of heroes.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think some fans might argue like Garak is, because a lot of the time what he does assists our heroes.
But I think Garak would argue that he's not a hero.
No, I would agree with that.
And he's fully self-aware of that.
Yeah.
So, but look.
Like, would you say Garak is a better spy than a lot of these, like, major spy figures we saw on the show? Like, I would say he's a better spy than Tane. Tane is, like, really driven by ego.
Yes, and Garak survives until the end of the series.
Yeah.
We can't say that for all the spies that we meet here. R.I.P., most of you.
Mm-hmm.
But, look, Julian does learn a lesson from Garak here, in that by the end of the episode, he learns how to walk away. And remember at the end, he lets Dr. Noah Love, played by one Ben Sisko,
right,
essentially destroy planet Earth,
yes,
in order to make the program, you know, finish to its end, to its conclusion.
Sisko's always wiping out groups of people.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
He's always pressing the button.
Pow, pow, Maquis colony.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess your atmosphere now.
That's an interesting parallel, actually. I wonder if that was in the writer's heads when they did that, or if it was just complete coincidence.
You know what? I think if you want to have some fun, you give the lead character the chance to play the villain for an episode.
But could you see them putting any other character in that sort of...
No.
Blofeld role, exactly. So it just kind of lines up. So I just wonder how much is happy accident there.
Do you think it's just the haircut?
Well, I mean, unless, you know, Colm Meaney really wanted to shave his head that week.
Yeah. One final thing. I'll just leave you with this question, and then let's get into the Section 31 stuff, because I think that's what a lot of people are waiting for here. But is Julian a good spy? Because he kept getting caught, and everybody knew who he was the entire time, where, like, he was trying to call himself, like, Patrick McGillicuddy or something.
Sure.
And it's like, no.
I mean...
Oh, no, Patrick Merriweather, which that's a great spy name.
Well, no, I don't think he's necessarily a great spy, because he wants to be James Bond, and I don't think James Bond is a good spy. One of the oldest jokes in the James Bond series is everyone knows he's a super spy. He, like, walks in, and the villain's like, that's the famous super spy James Bond. It's like, okay, well, cover blown, I guess. And so it's more like... Bashir wants kind of the swagger and the kind of the colorful, you know, accompaniments that come with being the spy. He wants to, you know, get the girl and all that sort of stuff. He sees, I don't know if they're watching James Bond movies in the future. I'm going to have to assume they are, given his love of this. But I guess I have a question for you. Which James Bond do you think he sees himself as?
I would say that he sees himself as a Connery.
I would say so, but this feels very Roger Moore a lot of the time to me.
But Roger Moore is kind of the no, you're talking about kind of the campiness, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, there is definite camp in a couple of the Connerys, but to me, like, the playfulness of it, kind of the inconsequential violence to it, feels more Roger Moore.
So I feel as if Julian is playing Connery in a Roger Moore film.
Yeah.
You know, but it's definitely...
But with more of, like, the 60s trappings in terms of, like, the villains and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
It's definitely not Timothy Dalton. I'll say that. Maybe George Lazenby.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Well, you know what? That actually isn't too off, actually.
Yeah.
The George Lazenby on Her Majesty's Secret Service actually does have a lot of the aesthetics you would actually see in this episode. So that does make sense. It's actually funny to me that they were planning to do more of these episodes.
And Roger Moore of them?
And MGM was not amused with this episode.
Really?
And apparently they sent a letter and they... Like,
cease and desist?
Pretty much. They're like, okay, enough's enough.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I remember when Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, came out, and MGM was having none of it with regards to the title.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had to come to some big agreement where, I guess, was it Paramount that put that one out?
New Line.
Okay. They had to agree to give them, like, free marketing for the next James Bond movie for, like, attach all the trailers or something to it or something like that. And I think there's also some issues in the UK because, like...
They changed the name altogether, I believe.
Yeah, because I think it literally means the F word
in
the UK. So that'd be great if we had posters here in Canada that said, The Spy Who F'd Me. It's
like, I may be wrong, but I think they just called it Austin Powers 2.
Okay.
Yeah.
you know what? Might as well. Don't expose children to that.
Yeah. Feel free to correct me, UK listeners.
Yeah. Also, I apologize if any of our British listeners are listening to this episode with their children right now.
As I would imagine all our British listeners do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, Cam, let's get into it. Mm-hmm. Section 31, introduced in Inquisition, which I think is actually a really underrated episode. Like, to me, this has so much tension going through it, where we have the introduction of one Sloane, who's working for Starfleet Intelligence, as we're led to believe, more of an administrator sort of fella, until we find out that he's been asking all these questions of Julian Bashir about his connections to the Dominion, putting him under extreme pressure, depriving him of sleep as well, really just to press him about whether or not he would be a good, you know, fit for their agency. Eventually, I like the fact that Julian actually figures it out sooner than Sloane would have liked, because he even says at the end, you know, I wanted to press you a little bit longer, but you figured it out, which actually shows that, yeah, Julian is actually maybe a good fit in terms of skills, but I don't know in terms of, say, the constitution of his personality.
Right. I mean, yeah, I like that he figures out earlier, because that just justifies why they would want him. He would have been really lame if they stretched it right to the end,
they're like,
revealed themselves, and he's like, oh, wow! And then they're like, now we want you for Section 31. He'd be like, why?
It'd be great if, like, you saw the other side of the holodeck. They're like, he hasn't figured it out yet? Really? We've been in here a week.
And they're wearing name tags that just say spy.
Yeah. But for me, this is actually a pretty great spy episode, and you don't even realize it's a spy episode until the end. So then you kind of get to rethink the episode, and it takes on like a whole different sort of layer the second time you watch this one.
I wonder how frustrating this episode would be, and I wish I could remember my first time watching it. I just can't at all. But how frustrating it would be for a viewer watching it their first time and watching this character just be tested over and over for information that we know is accurate.
Yes.
Like, I would imagine it would get very frustrating. I wish I could remember if I was frustrated watching it.
Well, I'll tell you what, my first impression or my first recollection of it is I thought it was a fine episode. Like, I mean, some interesting things with, like, the revelation at Section 31 is, like, this intelligence agency that is rogue, essentially. But as an episode in and of itself, I didn't think it was that great until I actually saw it again. And I knew going into it what the big reveal was. And I was like, oh, this makes more sense now. Yeah. I appreciate it so much more. I wonder if to a certain degree, narratively, it is flawed because it's kind of a frustrating watch for viewers, because you're kind of sitting there going like, what's going on? What's the story? They keep asking him the same questions. We know for a fact he's not a Dominion agent, you know, so this seems kind of pointless for us.
Yeah.
It's just a guy being a jerk to one of our favorite characters.
Well, it reminds me of, I believe it's Lethal Weapon 3, obviously. But, you know, in that movie, you know, it's Riggs and Murtaugh, our favorite cut-up cops, and, you know, Internal Affairs comes and investigates them. So we're watching our favorite characters just get grilled by characters who are really boring.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, we're going to take your badge and all that. And you're like, I don't really want to watch this. Like, I don't want to watch my favorite characters just get kicked around by a, like, bureaucrat character. And so, you know, it's a little bit like that. And I will say, when I watched Inquisition the second time, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah.
Like, it was an episode that I could totally see how it rewards repeat watchings versus maybe the first one's not so hot.
Yeah.
But especially when you get later down the road and see kind of the full scope of what Section 31 is.
And, well, you bring up the Lethal Weapon comparison with regards to boring characters from Internal Affairs.
Yeah.
Luther Sloane is not a boring character,
not
though.
Not at all.
And I think William Sadler is kind of the perfect guy to play this character as well, which I really dig. But why don't we jump over to the next big Section 31 episode? Because this one ends with Ben Sisko telling Bashir, yeah, if they ever ask you again, go ahead, say you'll join it.
Right.
Play along. I'm like, okay. I wonder if Starfleet Command was like wishing they had kind of rethought their official response to Ben when they kind of sort of didn't really deny the existence of Section 31. But
if you're Ben Sisko, is this irresponsible to send one of your crew members into a situation that seems very potentially dangerous?
And does Bashir really want to volunteer for that? Like, what does he have to gain from this?
Yeah, exactly. Do you think Picard would have ever suggested one of his crew join?
I think Picard would have said, look, Data, if they come to you, come tell me, I'll get you out of this.
Sure.
This is not cool, you know.
I feel like Kirk would be like, screw you, I'll do it myself.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm joining.
But so we follow up with Inter Arma Enim Silent Legis, which this is kind of a fun kind of spy intrigue, again with a high tension.
Yeah. Another episode I enjoyed way more the second time.
Yeah. And, well, you know, I dug it. Okay, I'll say this. I actually dug this more the first time than I did the second time, because we didn't really get into it with regards to Inquisition, but what do we kind of think about the idea of Section 31 existing within the UFP, as Sloan calls it? Which, right. I think, is this the first time that any character has actually called the United Federation of Planets the UFP?
I think it might be.
Yeah, yeah. Which is kind of cool. But anyway, sorry.
I think it adds a really interesting wrinkle to Star Trek, the idea of Roddenberry's utopia and what is the cost of it and how do you preserve that.
And Roddenberry would never allow such an organization within his own vision.
That ain't part of my human adventure.
No. But so how do you think this kind of, I don't know, can we square that circle to a certain degree? Or
I think it gets tougher to, yeah, it doesn't really work with the idea of Roddenberry's utopia. But yeah, I think it actually is a really interesting way of making you examine Roddenberry's utopia. Yeah. I think it's invaluable regard. And then
I agree.
Even making the decision yourself how you feel about it. Like, I like that it is a little controversial.
How do you feel about it? Because one of the best lines from Star Trek is when Ben Sisko says, I believe in the Maquis part one or two, he says, it's easy to be a saint when you're living in paradise.
Right, which actually inspired the Section 31, the creation of it. Yeah.
I kind of, well, I do agree with that.
Right.
And, I mean, the fact is, like, the Federation has its ideals, which seem very tough to live up to.
In a real world, yeah.
Well, not because of what's going on internally within the UFP, but the external factors that they're dealing with, because they're under attack by spies like Arne Darvin.
Sure.
You know, but it brings up, like, what do you do if you are facing off with an enemy that would go to any means? Do you just kind of shrug it off and bring it? And you'd hope that you'd be in a society that wants to preserve its ideals no matter what.
Right.
I would hope that Section 31 isn't really necessary, that it could be completely abolished and obliterated, although it seems to have wormed its way through the Starfleet sufficiently enough that seems impossible at this point.
Yes. Well, I do question whether it was ever a good idea to expand it beyond those DS9 episodes. Like, I think it's like the glimmer of that is an interesting question to really ponder, and I can totally see how fans of DS9 would really have some food for thought and some great discussion fodder, you know, to bicker back and forth whether or not it's justified within the Roddenberry utopia. But when you start expanding it into the wider canon of Star Trek, then, you know, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but then you kind of get into more issues of, like, well, I mean, how prominent is this thing? Because as represented by Luther Sloan in these DS9 episodes, it doesn't feel hugely widespread. Like, it feels very small, like kind of this pocket group of outsiders that just sort of exists.
Yeah, exactly.
They aren't, like, in every facet of society.
And they're not walking around with black badges on.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Great spy work there, guys.
And, you know, Luther Sloan, yeah, William Sadler is absolutely genius. I think he's one of the most underrated recurring characters in Star Trek. But, I mean, he doesn't feel like a guy who there's a lot of. He feels like a very unique type of individual.
Yes. And let's get into Inter Arma as well, because the whole name refers to, you know, in times of war, laws fall silent, which is what this surrounds. Not something I necessarily would like to believe in.
Right.
I will come down against one Admiral Ross. Yes, I'm a brave fan for saying that.
That's a bold choice.
It's my hot take.
Fan favorite. Star Trek sex symbol.
Yeah. Tyler Orton. Yeah. But it's bringing up a lot of interesting stuff with regards to the spycraft as well, because what we find out, though, is that Section 31 and the Tal Shiar, they're actually working with each other in order to influence Romulan politics, because Senator Kreatak, she's not actually in favor of the alliance, even though she's saying she is. It's really the Tal Shiar, Koval, the chairman of the Tal Shiar, he's the one who's vehemently against it. So it's easy for him to claim that he's a true patriot for the Romulans by saying he's really against the alliance, even though he actually supports it. Mm-hmm. So it is bringing up a lot of interesting back and forth. Think about all the planning that had to go on between Sloan and Koval to make sure that everything fell into place. It's very much like Heath Ledger Joker planning.
Yeah.
So it's still kind of
It's also very John le Carre, though, where there's so many intricate pieces.
Yes, Smiley. It sure is.
But what I appreciate is, unlike a movie like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, I can actually follow what's going on.
I love that movie. Oh, I know you hated it, but I
didn't
loved
hate
it.
But it's just,
you were bored out of your mind.
I was just like, I don't know what's going on.
Watch it
and
a second time.
And none of the
time.
Characters have any personality. Whereas the characters in Star Trek have plenty of personality. So to me, it's
Admiral Ross,
especially Admiral Ross. Yeah. But I mean, I like that. You know, when we saw Bashir being potentially recruited in the previous episode in Inquisition, I think there was a little bit of a question mark for a lot of us of like, is Bashir really that good a spy? Yeah. Like, is he the character you would want to bring into the society? Like, versus someone like, I don't know, like maybe a Kira would be better suited to this sort of work or something? Or, heck, they can go and get Garak or something. Yeah. I don't know. But, you know, you're kind of like, well, really, Bashir? But then you see how they're really just using Bashir to manipulate him through this episode.
And that was actually kind of the issue that I had on the second go of this. You know, I said that I didn't like it nearly as much the second time that I watched it. And it's because, like, Bashir's a passive agent. He's just being used as a tool. So it takes away a lot of his own agency that he's still actually possessed in Inquisition that is kind of removed from him here, which makes the viewing experience for me less enjoyable, though.
But you can also look at it a little bit as a field test for Bashir. Like, the first one was just them in a room with him, basically, interrogating him, where this is their first kind of shot of putting him in a position and trying to make him work against his instincts.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he delivers exactly what they predict he will.
Yeah.
And so you can see how they might go, okay, well, he doesn't quite have it yet. And you could almost look at this as Bashir's second test.
Okay.
And I kind of like it for that. You know, I like that he ultimately doesn't work with them, and you know, he doesn't really rub too well with what Section 31 wants to do. And I like that Sloan at the end is still just like, well, we may be calling on you again, you never know. But you know, Bashir is very much against them at this point, like he's just angry.
Yeah.
And so you can see, you know, I like that it doesn't try to gloss over the fact that no, he's an amazing agent.
Well, you know, maybe the show is coming down on the answer to Section 31, and that Bashir doesn't want to join them. He says, you guys do not live up to the ideals of the Federation.
Right.
And I think that's actually...
It's actually a good point, yeah.
It's showcasing the Roddenberry vision, though. You know,
through, like, Bashir, yeah.
Yeah, as much as we say that Roddenberry would never approve of something existing in the Roddenberry vision, the writers are essentially coming down hard against Section 31, saying, yes, this is not congruent with the society that we've established here. So,
and not only that, I mean, Bashir is expressing his outrage over how they treat Kreetak.
Yeah,
where she's like thrown into life in prison, potentially murdered. We don't really know.
Yeah,
over just because he got her to tap into Kovac's files.
Yeah,
you know, and it's like, wow, you know, he's the one who's outraged, and it's all about paranoia. You know, this is very Cold War again, where they're like, well, the Romulans may come against us after the Dominion War, so we better just screw this woman over. You know, and I like that it's Bashir who's saying, you know, I do not approve of this whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, I would never say that the show paints Sloan as like a really fun James Bond character. Like, he's not a charisma bomb where you're like, man, this guy's just the best. Like, I think Garak, they often do that. They're sure. Like, oh, we want you guys to love Garak.
Yeah.
I don't think, like, fans, quote unquote, love Sloan. I think he probably frustrates a lot of them.
Yeah.
But he's cool.
Yeah.
He's a very well-written, interesting character.
I agree. Yeah.
But he's not Mr. Cool Guy.
That's, again, my co-host, because he calls himself that.
Yeah, of course.
Well, why don't we go to the trilogy capper here for the DS9 Section 31 arc, Cam?
Yeah.
Extreme Measures, in which, look.
That was a Hugh Grant movie.
Was it?
The one where he was the doctor? The one with Gene Hackman is like the doctor who's like experimenting on patients or something?
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, random aside. 1995, I think it was.
There you go.
Yep.
Well, that's all I have to say about Extreme Measures. No, but of course, Bashir was just on a planet in the previous, in Inter Arma, at a medical convention on Romulus. Mm-hmm. And guess what? We end up going to find out that Section 31, they're really into biomedical research too, because they're the ones responsible for the Founder's disease.
Right.
So Bashir pretends he's figure out the cure. Luther comes to get it, and they're like, nope, sorry, gotcha. And Luther does the 24th century equivalent of a cyanide capsule.
Right.
And we get to watch Bashir and O'Brien go into Luther's brain.
Kind of like the movie The Cell.
Yeah.
Or we would see in Discovery with Lethe.
And his brain looks a lot like the corridors of the Defiant.
Well, that's just handy.
I have to say that this is a pretty disappointing end to I guess, the Section 31 we were introduced to the previous two seasons.
Well, do you ever buy that Luther Sloan would ever get caught this way?
No.
Because to me, he's a lot smarter than that. And I get it. He likes to watch Bashir sleep. But, yeah. I mean, I feel like he's not just walking in there willy-nilly. Like, he would have to have some sense if they're going to spring some sort of trap. And he would have a, you know, escape plan.
Yeah. You'd hope.
Yeah.
It seemed kind of like amateur hour.
It did.
Okay. Well, I don't really have too much to add about... I mean, where this leaves us with Section 31 at this point.
I don't dislike this episode, I guess, maybe as much as you do.
I think it was a victim of really bad timing because this is, just two episodes left before the finale of Deep Space Nine. And you're like, this is what they're spending one of our last hours on, is this?
I like the idea that it gives us sort of these glimpses into Luther Sloan's mind and lets us kind of take away for ourselves which ones were true, which ones weren't, how much of an actual human being was he? And so I appreciate it for that sense because this character is just all mystery. And if you're going to have a final episode basically sending him off, it's interesting to have that extra bit of depth given to him. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm not like, oh boy, I can't wait to get to that episode where they go inside Luther Sloan's head.
Yeah.
But what do you think of tying the ending of DS9 so tightly to a Section 31 plot?
I'm not a huge fan of it because it was such a late addition to the mythology of the series.
Mm-hmm.
But, maybe I feel a little bit mixed on it because they had been building it up and it was actually something that a lot of the fans were talking about and they dug. It just kind of... But you know, there was some retconning that actually kind of worked when they were talking about how they had actually introduced the disease into Odo when he was back on planet Earth in the Paradise Lost two-parter.
Right.
So... it does kind of work if you're throwing this question at me. Now, what are your thoughts?
I actually do like it, and I think it's because when you look at the whole series of DS9, there's so many tough decisions that characters make that the characters on other series would not. You know, you see with Sisko, as we referenced earlier, like gassing the Maquis settlement or, you know, in the Pale Moonlight, famously. And I like that ultimately the big decision with this war comes down to something that... Again, it's like, well, this is another Star Trek decision that was this the right decision? Like, I like that even at the end, DS9 is, yeah, we won the war, guys. Hooray, hooray, hooray. And then fans sit there and go like, well, wait a second. Was that the best way to do it? Like, was that justified?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a really great way to end a series and very fitting for what the series has always been, at least past, you know. Season one or two, and episodes like The Storyteller.
All right. We're going to talk about Section 31 still in just a moment, but why don't we just briefly segue to Voyager? Because I guess if they wanted to have their own version of spy stories, again, with a lot of cosmetic surgery, we do have the Seska story arc.
Right.
Which I don't think is a very effective spy story. Part of it is, A, she doesn't seem super competent.
Right.
B, she doesn't seem super compelling, like, say, a Garak would.
It doesn't help either, aligning her with, like, the Kazon characters.
Yeah, kind of like cavemen.
Yeah, are never played as particularly bright.
Yeah.
And so if she is this sort of spy on Voyager, you'd like to think she'd be aligning herself with smart characters as opposed to, like, just basically thugs.
Well, and I'm blanking on it. I don't think she was part of the Obsidian Order, though. I think she was just part of, like, Cardassian intelligence.
Right,
Yeah, so...
Why didn't they make her Obsidian Order? That would have been interesting.
You know what? I think with Voyager, it's just like, wait, we want to reference some intelligence agency brought up on Deep Space Nine. I think it would have just been kind of confusing. Like, a lot of fans who maybe didn't watch Deep Space Nine, they wouldn't know what the Obsidian Order is. Although you could explain it by saying it's an intelligence agency.
Right.
So, anyway. Why don't we hop back over to Section 31 again? Because, look, we do get a little bit of our history about it with Star Trek Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Affliction Divergence two-parter where we see that Reed had been recruited by Section 31 not too long ago.
Yeah, before they launched the NX-01, but yeah.
Yeah, so he felt compelled to do some deeds for this one operative here, Harris.
Yeah, to help them get Phlox to this Klingon area to try and solve the Klingon virus.
Yeah.
Because they were looking at potentially aligning with the Klingons at some point. Obviously, that didn't work out so hot. But
I wonder, Cam, if you and I probably aren't the biggest fans of Section 31 on Enterprise.
Right.
I wonder if a lot of it falls on the fact that we're going from one Sloan...
Mm-hmm.
to some generic kind of actor who isn't very memorable, who we just kind of watch over the view screen.
But wears, like, the same clothes.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's like black leather.
Yeah.
It's, like, sweet. Yeah. I have issues with Reed, I think, being Section 31. Like, I just, this character does not strike me as someone who, I don't know, like, Reed did not seem particularly ambiguous in terms of his morals. He did not seem like a character that was particularly willing to bend. He seems actually like, you know, the show would a lot of time portray him as very military-like, which I guess you can kind of tie him to Section 31, the idea of duty, but he also doesn't strike me as a character who would do immoral things. So I don't know that there's a character on Enterprise who'd be better suited. Probably not. I guess he's the best they've got.
Would it not have been amazing if it was revealed this entire time that Travis was actually a member of Section 31?
That would have been interesting.
It would have explained like why he's so dull. He's just trying to like fit in and not draw attention to himself. Like the Yarn Darvin example I gave.
But you know, with Bashir, you get the sense this guy wants that kind of world of intrigue.
Yeah.
With Reed, you don't get that sense.
Yeah.
He seems more annoyed about it, quite frankly. And, you know, he ultimately is like leaning on his captain and thrown in the brig over it.
I think Reed has far more loyalty to Archer than he does to the Section 31 organization.
Well, and he says that at the end. He chooses Archer over Section 31.
Yeah, but I don't know why he didn't do that at the beginning. Like, that's what's frustrating to me, because I didn't really buy what he was doing the entire time he was doing it.
And while I don't like aligning him with Section 31, I like the idea of doing more with that character, because a lot of the time, Reed, I actually think Dominic Keating brought a lot to the character.
Yeah.
It's just like the show didn't quite give him enough. Like, you could tell that the ingredients were there to make Reed a really, like, cool, badass character. And they just never quite took that extra step. It's kind of like Worf on TNG versus DS9.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's like, we never got our second series of Reed showing up and actually being, you know, fulfilled as the ultimate badass character we know he secretly could be.
Yeah.
Maybe another spinoff.
Yeah, and it didn't get that much better with regards to Demons and Terra Prime, that two-parter. Yeah. It's just Section 31's just kind of there. They're like, yeah, we've got some intelligence on this terrorist organization.
They're mostly exposition in this two-parter, saying, here's what Terra Prime are up to. I mean, they do end with saying, you know, we may be calling on you in the near future, ... in Enterprise Season 5.
Canceled. Yeah. I'll just say this, with regards to Enterprise, I don't think they really introduced anything all that interesting about Section 31.
No, they used it more as a plot device.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when Phlox is taken by the Klingons, you know, the ship is supposed to be speeding to save them. How do they slow them down? Well, here's a way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's a little more interesting than, like, there's a stray comet in our path or something. But I don't know how much it was really added to, for interesting storytelling versus just fan service.
I think it was a fan service deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, hats off to Manny Coto. He's actually quite good at navigating that throughout season 4 when he was showrunner. This is just a bit of a hiccup, in my opinion, here.
But would you even say he did it badly? I don't think he did it badly. I think it was
He didn't do anything interesting.
He didn't do anything interesting, but it doesn't feel offensive.
No, yeah, I agree with that.
And
yeah.
I don't think it's like a total betrayal of the character. So I think it of Malcolm Reed.
Yeah.
So it's not a great fit, but I also walk away just kind of shrugging my shoulders going, eh.
Yeah, but I wish I didn't have to shrug my shoulders.
Yeah.
But if you want to take maybe more of an offensive read on the depiction of Section 31, let's talk about Star Trek Into Darkness, Cam.
Everyone's favorite depiction of Section 31.
Well, I'll say this. I did enjoy this depiction of Section 31 because we got a lot of, I guess, more shades of gray. You and I just talked about it on this
Riker's
podcast.
Riker's leg.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes, it took. I'm really slow.
Yeah,
that's actually a pretty good joke.
Yeah.
But with regards to Into Darkness, it's just like mustache twirling Admiral Marcus, who's building starships that are manned by people in black and purple uniforms. Are
they Section 31? I guess so,
but then they seem to be like contractors or something. It's kind of vague to me. Or again, I'm slow. It may have been explicitly stated and I just totally missed it. I've seen this movie like 3 times already and I haven't.
Although 3 is not that many, really, when you break it down. I mean, you ask a lot of Star Trek fans how many times they've seen each of the movies.
Okay.
Probably more than 3.
I'm trying to think of how many times I've seen like First Contact.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than 3.
Yeah, I've seen Wrath of Khan probably 10, 12.
Yeah. And we'll be watching, well, I don't know. So for all those listeners, Cam and I, we will be in Las Vegas, August 1st through 5th at the Star Trek convention at the Rio Suites and Hotel. We have a panel scheduled for that week, so come on, see us. It's actually going to be based on one of our previous episodes, so you should be familiar with it. You'll get the live experience. We have new information to share. What I'm getting at is...
The live experience equals more dancing.
Yes. But what I'm getting at here, though, is that there will be screenings of movies by the pool in the evening. So I'm going to go to at least Star Trek First Contact once again. I don't know. Maybe we can do Wrath of Khan. Is that on the same night that the orchestra is playing, though?
It might be.
Yeah, so I wonder.
They're doing Wrath of Khan, Star Trek 2009, and what's the other one? Oh, Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, let's go back to Into Darkness. Like... It's a mustache twirling. I there wasn't really much interesting stuff for us to debate here. It actually comes back to something that I think more of a dangerous thing here, because I think Bob Orsi, he's very much into conspiracy theories like 9/11 truthers and all that. Bob Orsi being the co-writer of this. And this is what this actually comes down to. Section 31 is his way of writing about 9/11 conspiracies that he believes in, and that is actually the U.S. government responsible for the Twin Towers.
And he was very passionately defending a lot of these conspiracy theories on Twitter.
Like,
and then
to a scary degree.
Yeah, it kind of led to a bit of a public meltdown, and then he just disappeared off Twitter completely.
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at Bob Orsi, you haven't really seen him a lot tied to many movies.
Well, did you see that he is volunteering to come... work on the new stuff that Alex Kurtzman is working on?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Like, I just wonder, what is his persona in Hollywood right now?
I don't know.
I do wonder if he's kind of been run out a little bit. I know he still has producing credits on some TV shows, I think.
No.
Still going, but...
That could just be contractual
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. Like, I don't know how active he is.
But if we bring it back to Star Trek Into Darkness, I mean, this was... I think there's potential for them to do something interesting with, I guess, the bad side of Starfleet. And I do totally believe that Section 31 would align itself with, say, a Khan figure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that makes sense to me. But I think the way that it's executed... I mean, how many philosophical debates have you and I had about what was shown in Star Trek Into Darkness versus some of the other stuff that we've talked about on the podcast? Like, very few, I'd say, if any.
Right. Yeah.
So.
No, it's very true. And to me, I mean, on one hand, I guess I can kind of give them the mildest of kudos for tackling a very, I mean, to a non-Trek fan, very obscure element of Star Trek canon and trying to explore that in a two-hour movie. Like, a lot of... you know, TV series to movie adaptations would not tackle elements that obscure.
Yeah.
Just because it's like, why?
Of course.
It just invites so many questions you don't want the audience to be asking. So I can kind of give them slight props for trying. But yeah, I agree with you. It wasn't done in an interesting way. And I think maybe it was just too early in the Kelvinverse to do that type of story, because the first one is such a blast of like... we are going to go beyond, and you know, this is like the optimism that Star Trek is all about. And so I think you maybe want a second film that embraces that more and gives, you know, the crew like a big adventure where you're going to see this utopia, so that when you see it risked by a Section 31, it means something. Whereas I think as a second movie, you're already like, I don't know, the previous movie I saw Vulcan destroyed, and it's, you know, a lot of bad stuff happened there too. Like, it doesn't feel like
there's
as much to lose.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you want to feel like these characters can lose so much by the existence of Section 31. And I don't think the movie really does that, other than just having Marcus like fly around in the Vengeance and like really like violently threaten our heroes, which again it's not
and
very good.
Crash land in San Francisco.
Yeah, which again, like, going back to Section 31, I mean, I like to think their operatives are really bright, I would hope, you know, because they've existed as they have for a long time in secret. Marcus, to me, seems like he's just like crash landing in there in this big old ship that a lot of people are going to be able to report about.
And, well, and also, look, say what you want about Sloan. Did Sloan or even Harris seem unhinged?
No.
Whereas Marcus
does. They seem very focused.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So... I just don't think it was a great fit, but...
And just the use of Khan, like, I can kind of get behind, or at least understand, I should say, them using his crew to manipulate him to perform tasks for them. But then when you get into the whole, like, this is a guy from the 1990s designing, you know, 23rd century weapons.
Yeah, I know.
You're kind of like, this is your Section 31 plot? Like, this is a little goofy?
He's like, I've got an idea, guys. Russian trolls.
Yeah.
cyber warfare.
It's a little weird.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we jump over to Discovery, though? Because we do know that Section 31 will be appearing in Season 2, but actually Season 1 did feature Ash Tyler, which we talked about earlier. But, I mean, in terms of spy intrigue, I think maybe you and I feel a little bit mixed on this here. I just think that there's something fundamentally, I guess, unsatisfying with how everything shook out with Ash Tyler as a spy. He's ultimately a really bad spy.
Right.
What intelligence did he ever pass on to the Klingons? Nothing.
Yeah, not really, no.
And we also have his...
I just wonder if he was a failed experiment. Maybe that's the gist of the characters. He was a failed experiment.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the Arndarvan would be, like, the proper version of that later down
the road. Which I could buy, you know. I don't think that's what they went into it thinking it was going to be, you know. And also makes me wonder, okay, for the longest time, you and I were thinking about, you know, his handler, essentially, Laurel.
Right.
We were all like...
Who seems a much better spy than he is.
Is she, though? Because for the longest time, you and I, we couldn't figure out if everything was just going wrong for her,
right,
or if she had this huge master plan that, and she was just manipulating everybody the entire way. And we found out, no, everything was just going wrong for her. And that really took away a lot of agency from that character, who we both really like.
But doesn't Laurel seem like she would be a far better spy?
I don't know. I've seen no evidence.
She comes from a house of spies and deceivers.
And they look like they did a really crappy job, like, recruiting somebody and planting him.
Yeah.
You know, so I wonder, you know, where we go with I guess, the depiction of spycraft on Discovery, because we do know that Section 31 will be making an appearance.
Here's a question.
There's the deleted scene from Will You Take My Hand, where we see that officer, that agent, giving Emperor Georgiou a black badge,
which
to indicate
a lot of people have mocked since. Yeah,
she's in Section 31 now.
I have a question though.
Yeah, yeah.
Deleted scenes like that, is that canon?
I think it depends on what the creators say.
Yeah,
and the creators have said essentially yes.
Yeah.
So why not just put this scene as like a stinger after the credits? I think that would have been the best thing. Because it's actually funny, because I think stingers were actually a popular thing for movies first, but like a lot of TV shows that I'm watching the last, I'd say, 3 years, for their season finales, they'll put like surprise stingers at the end. And I think that would have been perfectly fine in this situation. Instead, they gave it a couple weeks after Will You Take My Hand aired. And then you and I both kind of shook our heads going, oh boy. Like, you and I don't necessarily want to see Section 31 come back on Discovery at this point.
Well, I think this kind of goes back to what I was saying about the use of Section 31 on DS9. Like, I think the introduction of it there in just those, like, three episodes, and really maybe even just two episodes, it gave fans a lot to talk about in terms of, like, what could this mean in Roddenberry's utopia? But I kind of feel like maybe that conversation is kind of done. Like, I feel like fans have decided where they stood, and I don't know that there's that much more to explore. Like, I feel like the only reason you're introducing them in maybe Discovery is just to kind of have cool spy stuff.
But I think, okay, we could have the cool spy stuff, but guess what? We're also going to have to deal with Burnham coming up to this, and we're going to have to listen to the same speech from her every time, where this is not Federation ideals.
Right.
Which we heard that speech in the finale. And it was a pretty painful speech to listen to. I don't even know what "We Are Starfleet" means. It just seems like this generic sort of thing that you say, like, I believe in my beliefs.
Sure.
So it's like, and I'm just very fearful we're going to have to listen to her go on, like, this big, long monologue along the same lines, where I like what Bashir was doing, where he was pushing back. No matter my criticism of Inter Arma, he is a bit more of a... you know, an active agent, and I don't mean that intelligence agent, but like a narrative agent, and we see that in Extreme Measures, as much as I wasn't a fan of that one. I just don't know if we have Georgiou being recruited here. What we're going to see is the writers living vicariously through Georgiou, because they're like, oh, she's a bad character, so we can watch her do bad things, and you don't have to feel guilty as audience members. It's really why I hate The Walking Dead, where it's essentially just an excuse to watch rednecks go shoot people in the head. And I'm just like, it's something almost mean-spirited that they're depicting here in a way that I don't like. And that's what I'm very fearful of the Section 31 portrayal being on Discovery Season 2.
Well, and if you look at these other spy characters we've talked about, you know, like Tane or Sloane in Section 31, or Garrick with the Obsidian Order. Like, these characters are very committed to their cause, and like, you can understand why they would risk it all because they believe in, you know, this mission. Whereas, like, I don't think Emperor Giorgio gives a crap either way. Like, yeah, okay, sure, she'll sign up with Section 31 because she gets to potentially blow up more planets like she did the Klingon one.
Yeah.
But ultimately, she's kind of a loose cannon. Like, she's not committed to the cause of Section 31. So, like, really, what are we doing? Are we just watching Section 31 make stupid decisions? Because you're not going to have these interesting philosophical discussions like you would with a Sloan character talking about, you know, you're not going to have Giorgio saying, you don't understand, we have to save the galaxy because this, this, and this. It's more like she's just a loose cannon that they're going to have to send, you know, Burnham in to stop.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why did you let this... It's kind of the Khan problem again. It's like, you know, you bring in a character like Khan who is just kind of like an animal on a leash. And once he gets off that leash, he's going to cause a lot of problems.
Don't you already feel like you know where this storyline is going?
Do you think she's going to crush someone's head?
Maybe. I just kind of feel like I'll be shocked if wherever they go with the Section 31 story, if anything surprises me. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's going to be kind of predictable sort of storytelling. And I don't think we're going to find out, you know what, Section 31, they all have hearts of gold deep down. Or, you know what, Emperor Giorgio, she's turned a new page on life because of Section 31. It's like, no, it's going to be watching Giorgio do bad things and Burnham having to go stop her.
Right. And I would be totally fine if this was one episode of Discovery. If it was just like, here's our black badge, you know, Section 31 episode with Giorgio. Okay, cool. But I know the way this show is structured is that it's these, like, ongoing arcs. Yeah. And so it's like, there's no way I'm getting one episode of Section 31. Like, I'm probably getting maybe 6 or 7 episodes or something like that. You know, like the Mirror Universe, which was, what, 5 episodes, I think?
Four episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to get this extended Section 31 story, which, I mean, we talked a lot last season, and we gave a lot of compliments, a ton, to Star Trek Discovery, but we saw very few Strange New Worlds or anything like that. And to me, Section 31 is so earthbound.
They're not emblematic of exploring new life and new civilization. So it means whatever Section 31 journeys, it's not going to be taking us to, I don't know, do diplomatic, you know, introductions to new species or anything. That's what I want to see in Star Trek.
It's kind of the Star Trek Into Darkness problem, where the first one ends with, like, the galaxy is open, we can do anything we want, now we go back to Earth and deal with Section 31.
Yeah.
And I'm just not that excited to see that for season 2 of Discovery, which a show that I think has boundless potential.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm all for fan service done well, but Star Trek Discovery's done a lot of fan service stuff right out of the gate, and I think when you do too much of it, it seems like you are very...
Pandering?
Pandering,
or not confident. Yeah, not in confident what you in yourself. Can do. Yeah,
yeah,
I agree.
So, I did have one question for you, though.
Okay.
You know, we were talking about, for example, whether Reed is a good Section 31 operative, and, you know, Bashir, is he a good agent? Which Star Trek characters do you think would be good?
Are we talking main cast?
Main cast. Who would be good Section 31 operatives?
I think it'd be Chakotay. And I know you're thinking, really?
Because he's such a blank that no one would notice him in a crowd?
Well,
minus the tattoo,
I guess. Minus the tattoo. I think
they might have to take that off.
I think there's that. But I think, look, Chakotay is somebody who shoved away his Starfleet career.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's not somebody who's going to... I think he could see the shades of gray in things. You know, he
Riker's
joins...
leg.
Yes. He joins the Maquis, right?
Right.
I think what we've seen with Chakotay, he is a competent, you know, officer. He can shoot a phaser. He can pilot a shuttle. You know, I think his ability to be kind of flexible to a certain degree, I think that would, I know it sounds like such a weird pick, but
it makes sense.
But I was actually thinking about this, like, as we were doing this podcast, and I was like, when we were talking about the Voyager one specifically, and I was like, I think it might be Chakotay. But what about you, Cam?
Well, Chakotay makes a lot of sense because he was, you know, very dedicated to the Maquis. And then he was very dedicated to Starfleet. Like, you could see how his commitments could be manipulated, and he could be brought over to something like Section 31. How do you think someone like Seven of Nine would do?
That's actually very interesting.
Because Seven of Nine, you know, look, she would probably be brought in a similar circumstance as Khan, where she's not necessarily brought in like the Bashir thing, where they're, you know, running all these tests to test her. I feel like it would be more like, ooh, here's someone who has a lot of abilities, who has been disconnected from humanity for a long time, who we can kind of manipulate to our own ends and could maybe become almost like a Garrick-like agent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would be very much that kind of, you know, again, this is a loaded word to say, but kind of that grooming someone for to become an operative. More of the sense of just recruiting.
I agree. And I think, like you said, it's like I see why Section 31 would want her from intelligence, just her physical prowess. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think the fact that she's not somebody who grew up as a Federation. Well, I guess she was born a Federation citizen, but she not.
That was a long time ago.
She didn't grow up, pushing ahead with these Federation ideals. So I think, yes, that moral ambiguity that she could see, what just makes more logical sense there. I think she'd make for a pretty interesting agent.
And you could see them holding information about her past over her head.
Yeah.
Like, we'll give you this if you do this for us.
Yep.
Like, you could totally see it. And someone like Luther Sloan would be more than happy to do that. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we had news and rumors a little while ago about a possible Captain Picard spinoff. We might be getting some more news from Comic-Con. Star Trek's going to have a panel there. But even if we don't get any news about this Captain Picard spinoff, we're going to talk about what the potential is for a series like this, starring Patrick Stewart, whether we'd bring in new characters to serve on this crew, or we're going to be seeing a lot of old faces. I would not be surprised by that. But I think what we want to get to here is whether there's real viability for doing a Picard spinoff and what it would look like, how the format would work. And maybe we can talk a little bit about some other ideas floating out there for what Alex Kurtzman will be doing with regards to creating more content for Star Trek in the next 5 years.
Very cool. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vulcan Martial Arts, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O. O is in Obsidian. R-T-O. O is in order. N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.